So tonight, continuing with our study of how to cook your life from the Zen kitchen to enlightenment, based on Dogen's Tenzo Kyokan and with chapters commentary by Uchiyama Roshi. And I just really love this book because it's all based on the Tenzo Kyokan, but every chapter brings something else in. So it's a very, each chapter is very different. So this chapter tonight is called Passion for Life. Having a Passion for Life. So he starts off by saying Sawaki Roshi, which was his teacher. Sawaki Roshi often said, in the Theravada school of Buddhism, any act is pardonable, providing the motive is good. However, in Mahayana Buddhism, if the result is bad, there is no pardon for the act, despite one's good intention. Since the overall practice in Mahayana Buddhism must be good, there is no room for carelessness. The difference between Theravada and Mahayana, then, is that in Mahayana Buddhism, life is the most essential matter. So, this is true at a sort of sectarian level. That isn't the most important message here. But there is a development when he said Theravadan Buddhism, you know, original Buddhism that is represented today in Theravadan Buddhism, which means the way of the elders. So a way of a type of Buddhism that is preserved as much as, I'm sure it has evolved, but in many ways has preserved the practice and the teachings as they were shortly after the Buddha died. And in that tradition, in that teaching, it is really it's your intention, it's your state of mind. So if you do something meaning well, but it has a negative effect, what matters most is that you meant well. But similarly, if you have an ill intent, that has very negative consequences in the world, but in your own heart and mind as well. But there is quite a lot of emphasis on our own mind and body and practice. And that, to some extent, that is very, very much a part of our practice. Us examining our own motivations and understandings and intentions and, that's a huge part of our practice, is that internally focused practice. But Mahayana Buddhism asks us to do something more. And I like to think that this strand of Buddhism arose because practitioners saw there was something missing. Not to say that there's something missing in Theravadan practitioners. They will have their own way of fulfilling and completing the spiritual path. But to some extent, you could look at that emphasis on it's only your intention that matters as being kind of selfish in a way, right? What about the impact on others? What about your impact on the larger world? What about your responsibility to life? So he says, in Mahayana Buddhism, life is the most essential matter. So we are responsible. So the way that we describe this when we are studying the moral precepts is that intention definitely does matter. Definitely. I mean, it makes a huge difference if you accidentally kill somebody versus if you murdered them. I mean, that's a very different situation karmically, externally and internally. However, what we say is there's always negative consequences. And I think we can appreciate this. If we did accidentally kill someone, It's not, that is not without karmic consequence, especially if we accidentally killed somebody because of our negligence, or because we were intoxicated, or because, out of ignorance even. So we have a greater responsibility in Mahayana Buddhism. And this is a fundamental, it's not just about, different types of religion. It's a pretty fundamental spiritual question. If we want to be good, we want to live a good life, what do we do? What are we responsible for? How do we do that? How do we be a good person? How do we be a moral person? Our intention versus effect. So I think many of us are experiencing a manifestation of this right now, particularly those of us who are white, recognizing that no matter our intention, no matter our inner attitudes, that we are part of a system that is racist, and that we have white privilege, that we have experienced different, our whiteness has affected our lives, our opportunities, our challenges. So on the one hand, we should work on our internal prejudices, and it's much better to at least not be like overtly racist, but that's not at all that matters. It's not just our intention, it's also the effect. So having to educate ourselves, having to look beyond just our immediate intention and our immediate, what we're immediately aware of, to beyond, to what are the implications? What are the effects in a larger frame? And I think similarly, as Mahayana Buddhists, as when we're participating in systems that are leading to something like the climate crisis, vast global inequality, again, it isn't our intention, but we're not free of responsibility. So in Mahayana Buddhism, our responsibility extends infinitely. And this is because, or not because, I mean, but the way that we view things is that everything is interdependent. I can't actually get enlightened and awakened and liberated and screw you. That's just not actually the way that it works. Your well-being is intimately tied to my well-being. Just having to cut off and not care about your well-being is going to make it impossible for me to really be liberated. Even if over here I can be in some little bubble that feels enlightened, if I don't care about you as well, then it's not really enlightenment. So, I'm not sure whether this is going to be a question people get their heads around, but I was thinking that we would go into breakout rooms and think about an aspect of your life, whether this is your sense of connection to the larger world, or this is something within your immediate life and your relationships with family members, your experiences at work or something, where you feel like, you have a good intention, but then it's a struggle perhaps to match that intention with the effect. And where you end up having to really really be honest with yourself and learn and observe and watch and recognize how your behavior and your choices have effects that you don't necessarily intend, and that where you need to work on that. Because then we're going on to talk about how do we do this? How do we deal with the things in our lives in a way that, as Ryuichi Yamauroshi talks about, and then Tenzo Kyoken, he talks about the Tenzo taking this kind of Mahayana responsibility about things, but at the same time, having a particular attitude toward it that means that you don't get too absorbed in one aspect of it, but are able to see the whole thing. So anyway, I don't know if this will make any sense, but what is something in your life, some area of your life where there's a challenge, you're trying to be a good person, you're trying to be a good mom, a good dad, a good coworker, a good spouse, but your intention doesn't necessarily match up with the effects. So, let's see. Okie dokie. So, when we are trying to confront an issue, something in our lives, something out in the world that we have that Mahayana responsibility for, how do we do it? So as Ryuichi Yamauroshi was talking about, he said oftentimes we do it by adopting an agenda, you know, forming an opinion, adopting an ideology, and, you know, we mean well, right? We've got that good intention. But then he talks about, are we becoming so absorbed in one aspect that we lose sight of the other aspects? So he shares this section of the Tenzo Kyoken. The instructions to the cook. Do not be absent-minded in your activities, nor so absorbed in one aspect of a matter that you fail to see its other aspects. Future students must be able to see that side from this side, as well as this side from that side. Practicing with intense effort, using all your ingenuity, you will be able to grasp genuine Zen that goes beyond the surface of characters. To do otherwise will only result in your being led about by variously tainted Zen that will leave you incapable of preparing meals skillfully for the community. So do not be absent-minded in your activities, nor so absorbed in one aspect of a matter that you fail to see its other aspects. So, you know, earlier in the Tenzo Kyoken, or in another place in the Tenzo Kyoken, Dogen talks about, you know, washing the rice and not losing a single grain, or treating the water as your own blood, or the utensils as your own eyes. So you can easily imagine somebody, you know, focused on that in the kitchen. And there they are, like, you need the rice now so it can get cooked in time for lunch. And somebody's over there washing it, making sure they don't miss a piece. So that would be an example, right, of being so absorbed in one aspect that you lose sight of the other aspects. Which is, this is the tricky thing about life, right? If we could just concentrate on one thing at a time, it'd be much easier. So, you know, in terms of going out into everyday life, you know, what does it mean to be so absorbed in one aspect of something that you forget all the other aspects? I guess I'll throw that open.
I'm glad you did. Because it immediately put me in mind of, first of all, I've listened to a radio program now, part one yesterday and part two today as I was cleaning up the kitchen, on the cancel culture. So it immediately put me in mind of that, where it is becoming more and more normal for us to be intolerant of people who don't look at something exactly the way we do. And I find that frightening. I find that really, how did we get here? That's what this is putting me in mind of. I don't know if that connection makes sense.
Other thoughts?
I hate it when people don't see things the way I do. I'm getting so pissed off about it.
Mark, go ahead and unmute yourself.
You have to unmute, Mark.
I'm sorry. Yes, we have a similar situation here where we have the indigenous. Well, I'm in the same position, but I come from it a little bit differently, Jinru. I like to give a solid, concrete example. We have a sacred site just outside. Overlooks the township of Mbantwe or Alice Springs, where I live. And this sacred site has been an important meeting place for the women here for the last, now wrap your minds around this, the last 30,000 years. Okay. That small hill has been made into a memorial named Anzac Hill, a memorial Anzac Australian and New Zealand Army Corps. It became a memorial for those who've died in the various wars fighting for either Australian or New Zealand in the last. And there it is, plonk, right on the top of the sacred site. And I look at that and I say, how could this have happened? How could people be so insensitive? So sometimes cancel culture is good. In the sense that it actually, you know, I guess it's from your point, it's that we don't take into account the other feelings. But sometimes I feel in a next concrete case like this, you know, if you were to raise this and say, let's get on with it and move the memorial somewhere else, that would offend half the population in the city, you know. So I don't know how you deal with that sort of thing. But it's, anyway, I've spoken too long and I apologize.
No. Ruthanne,
Sometimes we never know. With world consciousness, I've been told by some shamans that we're in a better shape than we were even 50 years ago. It certainly doesn't seem like that. But like a mud sewer, things float to the top. And people around the world are requesting monuments be removed or at least considered. So I think for any of us individually and even in our society, to say what sits on our heart, and if something gnaws at us, maybe it's valid to check our own personal intention. And then sometimes take it out to the wider arena and say it's not on, because isn't that in a way what Black Lives Matter or any, you know, get children out of prison on the border? I mean, really. Thank you.
Thanks, Ruth Ann. Yeah, and I think my mind also went to cancel culture as an example of being so absorbed in one thing that you lose sight of other things. And I think it's so it's not a matter at all of you know, the rightness or wrongness of these particular issues. And this is an amazing time with all of these things being so upfront and questioned. And you know, we've got a cohort of people at our Sangha going through Awakening to Whiteness right now. And so we're becoming much more aware of these things, much more aware, right? This is becoming aware of the effects. It's not just about our intention, it's learning about the effects. So that's that Mahayana requirement. At the same time, you know, I don't think any of us would say that the damage done by cancel culture outweighs the damage done by racism and other forms of exploitation. But is it skillful? Is it helpful? Is it the most useful response when, you know, the mayor of Minneapolis was honest and did not want to be put on the spot saying that he wanted to defund the police, which is a complicated discussion, you know? I mean, and he was completely booed off the stand. He was that to me is like, well, that's kind of like that being absorbed in such one aspect that you can't see what would actually be useful. You can't see, you know, who you are speaking with, what would be helpful. Jeanri, you look like you really want to say something.
Well, that is exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. And when you bring it down to the level of your friend, I look at it this way, you look at it that way. Can't our world be big enough to where I can look at it this way and you can look at it that way and we can still be friends? That's what I am most troubled by. Mm-hmm. I am troubled by the divisiveness of this attitude.
Yeah, you're not even...
That drives right down to individuals.
And you're not even, to some extent, you're not even human anymore.
If I
think you have the wrong attitude, you're just despicable. And here's another example, just to get us off of that particular one. I've been reading, actually listening by audiobook, Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change. And it's a really good book. And... Toward the end, he's talking about religion and what the climate movement can learn from religion in terms of, you know, getting things across to people and getting people mobilized. And so this is an example, I think, of where those of us who are very concerned about the climate emergency and we're trying to mobilize and we're trying to get changes made, you know, we've gotten so absorbed in one aspect, in a way, again, that what we're doing is not necessarily helpful. So he says, the critics are right in this regard. If climate change were a religion, it would be a wretched one, offering guilt and blame and fear, but with no recourse to salvation or forgiveness. Guilt is a word that appears all the time around climate change. Is it just me, or does everyone else feel guilty for being alive too? Wrote Jeremy Burgess in an opinion piece in The New Scientist. What is missing, Burgess noticed, is forgiveness. And failing this, we can only look forward to punishment. Sally Weintraub, a psychotherapist, agrees. Without forgiveness, she writes, our feelings about climate change will become stuck in a climate of hatred, bitter recrimination and relentlessness, easily feeling harshly judged, and not moving toward accepting the reality of loss. So he suggests, as an alternative, we could learn to find ways to address the feelings of blame and guilt that lead people to ignore or deny the issue by enabling people to admit their failings, to be forgiven, and to aim higher. By concentrating on universal and non-negotiable sacred values, we could sidestep the arid cost-benefit calculations, which encourage us to pass the costs on to future generations. So that when I heard that one, it was like kind of like, oh yeah, you know, that recognizing we're so attached to our own rightness. So in terms of how do we put our energy and the way that Uchiyama Roshi puts it here, it is fundamental that you put your energy into the wholeness of life before you get carried away by a single aspect or a single view of a situation. So how do we do that? And he shares a really sweet story here. In a book by Goro Nakanishi, there's a story about how a bird hatches its eggs. While the female bird warms the eggs, she periodically gets up, turns them over with her beak, and sits down again. The eggs will not hatch well if she only warms one side and leaves the other side cool. Yet it does not appear that she turns the eggs over because she thinks consciously that it is time to do so. Rather, she seems to do it because as she sits on the eggs, her abdomen gets very warm. And by turning the eggs over, she can cool herself by pressing her abdomen on the other relatively cool side of the egg. Our passion for life works in this same way. When your passion embraces the wholeness of life, you naturally look around to see what is cool and needs to be taken care of. This feeling of passion that arises naturally is the activity or the function of our lives. So how does that look? What does that mean? How does that look in our lives, in our practice? As opposed to getting overly absorbed in one aspect of a situation, noticing what's cool.
I've been thinking about this a lot over the past couple of days, but so many different aspects of this, but that in particular just makes me feel why. It reminds me of, it might have been a recent Thich Nhat Hanh book we read where he talked about Zazen being a body practice. And in a recent session I went to, this came up as well. It's, you know, just stop thinking about what I think. Stop thinking about what this self, this executor and editor has to say, and just be. Feel the breeze, feel where it's cool. Notice what needs to be done. That's what this is feeling like to me.
I think for me, one of the important things to keep in mind is I try to keep the long view in mind, because we can get very fixated on short-term cause and effect. and first order cause and effect. And I often think that, like, I don't know about climate change per se, but there's a lot of things where, you know, cancel culture might be a good example, where it's kind of, in my opinion, it's kind of an extreme reaction to what I kind of see as a lot of people's lack of voice and kind of a lot of injustice in the world right now. And so there's this kind of pendulum swing that goes way to the other side. And so, you know, not necessarily to defend that, but also kind of in that area, in a more softer view, is the idea of boycott, right? Like, boycott is, I think, incredibly important democratic way to express yourself. But is that cancel culture? I don't know. So, you know, again, it's like finding these pendulums. The notion of a pendulum always seems to help me kind of find a balance. So that's my two cents.
I think a lot of it also just comes down to attachment and attachment to results. You know, I've chosen the life of a householder. I'm not in a monastery somewhere, so I'm going to be in the muckiness of the world. And then I can choose to just stay at home and watch Netflix, or I can choose to, like, take part in the world. And so I choose to take part in the world and be active. And then from there, I choose to take these certain actions. But the question is, am I going to at some point attach myself to the results? And I think that's where cancel culture comes in. I think I drive myself nuts when I do that, when I try to attach to the results. So I think that's the great trick of living and living a spiritual life, is being active in the world, fighting for our beliefs, you know, fighting for what we believe is right, and at the same time, not attaching to it and driving ourselves and other people nuts. And that's what cancel culture is it's when I'm so attached to the results of my beliefs or the actions that I've taken that I can't deal with anything else, and I'm going to cut it out. And it's like, that's the great question, is how can I be involved? How can I be active in this world? How can I take part, and how can I not attach? I don't know the answer. I have no clue. Somebody tell me. Mm-hmm. Domio, please.
That's how I read the goalless goal. If I hang there, I don't have to have answers. Just like being on a tightrope, just, you know, enjoy the view.
Well, I think eventually cancel culture gets very lonely, because I think at some point we're going to cancel everyone around us. So again, it's how do we have that intent and the action and stay spiritually grounded as well. I don't know.
Yeah, they've been pointing out recently how frequently those who cancel end up getting canceled at some point, you know? So it's a thing where, like, if we have this judgmentalism about others, then we're very well aware that we might be judged at some point that as well. So if we're honest, if we have a doubt, if we have a question, then we need to keep it hidden or face the consequences. And as Ruth Ann was saying about the kind of don't know mind openness as well. Yeah, there's like, that's kind of a giving up of control, of somebody in our group was actually talking about, you know, having one of those discussions where you just, you know, you end up having to make your point to someone, you know, because they're wrong, and you've got to prove your point. And even though you know, kind of in retrospect, you realize you're not going to change the person's mind, but you just have to, because you're right, you just have to say it. You just gotta do it. And for me, I've noticed like that, it always just feels like that practice of, I guess that practice of stepping back. I mean, it's exactly like Reddy says, like you're absorbed in one aspect of the situation and just kind of widening your perspective to include everything. And I realized like, okay, I'm focused on this debate. And if I open it up and I include, you know, my body and my breath and this other person, and then I kind of become aware of like, this other person is just as attached to their viewpoint as I am to mine. If I argue, like this is, I'm only going to entrench them in their view some more. I don't even know what their view is. Maybe it would help if I asked them some questions. You know, it's just like these other possibilities start opening up.
I'm just on that. I have a Zen friend who's a Chinese translator here in Australia. And he often observes that the more correct translation of dol or save, when we say save all sentient beings, is more correct translation, according to him, is include.
Oh.
So rather than save all sentient beings, I vow to include all sentient beings. So I think that's pertinent.
I don't know. I don't know if it's true or not. I've never heard that, but I sure like it.
He knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, and that whole sense of like, yeah, of extending our sense of responsibility to all beings, which is a really radical, you know, certainly we look after ourselves, our immediate families, our friends, but like, no, like it's asking us to include everyone. Bob.
Hey, the Blue Hound works. The Blue Hound works. Gosh. Hey, so I had a couple thoughts about the word engagement. You know, engagement to me is a very positive word. I don't want to take it far as marriage, but engagement is good. And we should never break off engagement. You know, it's the breaking off of engagement that creates problems. And of course, I'm going to do that when I'm angry and all pissed off and everything. But when my better self comes back into play, or equanimity reestablishes a little bit, then I can feel like, well, you know what? What I want to do is to find a way to engage or re-engage rather than just cutting off. And I think that goes along very well, what was said earlier. It's like, no, we're not necessarily trying to save people, but we're trying to stay with them.
Mm. Like that. Yeah, I mean, if we're so focused on the rightness or wrongness of some particular opinion or situation, we can totally lose perspective that what we really want is the welfare of all beings. So what does that look like? If we're just like making sure we don't lose any rice, but then the monastery doesn't get fed because we're still over there counting rice.
You know, I grew up that way. You don't waste a grain.
So in closing, I'll just end with a little bit of Uchiyama's words. What often prevents us from seeing and taking care of our life in its widest dimensions and covers over our passion for life is fanaticism, political, philosophical, as well as following of a blind devotion to some new discovery or knowledge about one aspect of a subject. It is not that new discoveries or knowledge are in themselves bad, but blind faith and devotion to any particular thing eventually leads to the stifling of life as a whole. You have to see everything that you learn from the foundation of the life of the self. Future practitioners must be able to see that side from this side as well as this side from that side. When your actions arise out of the wholeness of life, then you will be able to comprehend that passion which functions in all things and constantly moves in the direction of life. So it's a pretty simple, that's a pretty simple instruction, really. It's essentially pay attention and keep your heart open. So you can tell, you know, when the egg is getting cool or too hot and where you should turn it over. Isn't it easy? All right, I will close. We offer the merit of our practice to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom.
Wisdom beyond wisdom.
Maha Prajna.
Paramita. Prajna. Paramita.
Great talk and great discussion, everybody.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Sweet dreams.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.